stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Hello and welcome back to another segment of Black Op Radio. This is our part three for tonight. Anyway, Black Op Radio, and we are glad, excited to have a guest in studio from Australia, John Costella. Hello,
hey.
John.
How are you going, mate?
Well, if people can see us, we can wave. We've got a webcam going.
G'day.
Well, what brings you to Vancouver?
Well, I was actually here walking around Vancouver this afternoon. I'm visiting some colleagues at British Columbia Cancer Centre. I'm doing some work for Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne, Australia at the moment. Also doing some other work for Thomson Reuters, which brought me to the States. So I jumped up to Vancouver to speak to these other colleagues. Walking around Vancouver this afternoon, I thought, it's a pity I don't know anybody in Vancouver. And then I was, through my mind was coming this, the show the NSA doesn't want you to hear. And then I'm thinking, hang on, where, Vancouver, British Columbia, where, how do I, who do I, oh, no, so jumped in a cab and got down here from the hotel and halfway through that last one. So it's fantastic to be here in the studio.
Great, great. Glad to have you here. So you've done a lot of, you know, have a lot of interest in the JFK assassination, done a lot of work. I see your name on the forums. You've been a guest on the show before. Let's talk about your work on the assassination. I guess for anybody maybe listening right now that doesn't know about you, why don't you give us a brief background of what got your interest in and what you're doing right now?
Okay, no problems. Well, I guess it's been a lot of years since I've been on the show, probably 7 or 8 years.
Wow, a long time.
I think so. I don't think I've been back on the show since. But my background originally was engineering and physics and those sort of things. I've done a lot of different things, teaching, worked at defense reliability, and worked in finance more recently. So there since I've been on the show last. But probably about 10 years ago, I was actually working on some image processing ideas. Came across some frames of the Zapruder film and thought, oh yeah, these would be good examples because they're pretty famous. One thing led to another, and I started getting involved with these people on the forums like Jim Fetzer and others who actually believed the Zapruder film wasn't the genuine article, which was pretty surprising at the time. And then I started doing some work on it, and ultimately Jim invited me to the Duluth Zapruder Film Symposium in May 2003, and I think it was somewhere around that time that I was on your show a couple of times. 2002, 2003, I think, maybe 2004. And later that year, the book The Great Zapruder Film Hoax came out, which I was, you know, privileged to contribute a couple of chapters to as well. I guess back then, the work that I did was looking at some of the physical evidence that tells me that the Zapruder film can't be the genuine article. There's some very subtle physical evidence, and, you know, I've got a bit of that on my website, and you can also look up The Great Zapruder Film Hoax.
Right,
book
right.
And actually the whole symposium is now Rich De La Rosa, the late Rich De La Rosa, actually posted all of the DVDs on YouTube, and they're still there. People can go and have actually watch what we you can see what I look like with an extra 55 pounds or 25 kilos.
Okay, well, where's your website to start with then?
My website, the easiest thing is just to Google my name, John Costella, C-O-S-T-E-L-L-A. And it comes up number one, and you can find it. But
right, okay.
It's johncostella.webs.com.
Right, okay, I'll make a link to that.
Yeah.
Right.
As I said, a lot of the early work was the physical work, and that was what was in the book. I guess what we, and I won't go over that again, I'm sure you can sell people the archives and they can go and have a look.
You know, just briefly,
all right.
you discovered anomalies in the film, and
yeah.
To lead the conclusion that there's something wrong with the film. And
yeah,
to my mind, there's a debate in the word alteration or complete recreation. So let us know where you stand.
Yeah, well, I'm very clearly in the camp that it has to be a complete fabrication. You can't do small alterations. From the work I did, if you want to take a more neutral point of view, Sorry, that's a Wikipedia thing. I shouldn't have used that.
But, no, that's okay.
Wikigander. But some of the work I did with the ghost panels and the blur in the film shows that there's only two possibilities. One is that the whole film is completely genuine and it's almost impossible to alter. That's the default position you'd have until you find otherwise. And the other alternative is that if some changes were made, you had to basically recreate a whole complete new film. You had to have other footage and create a whole new film. And the reason that's the case is because each frame is connected to each other frame before it and afterwards. In the area between the sprocket holes where the film is pulled through, there's double exposures there, because in a normal film you don't see that. They didn't care about masking off that part of the film where the mechanism pulls the film through. And so with double exposures, you can't actually undo a double exposure. I don't know if you've ever taken a double exposure. My first...
accidentally, right? I know.
Yeah, my
is,
first
right?
camera, when I was 8 years old, I took a double exposure, and to this day, it's impossible to undo them. And so what it means is you can't start with a film that has these double exposures in the between the sprocket holes and undo it, change it, and then put it back together. It's not actually possible. You need to put new... You have to start with some source of material. Now, I'm not saying it was like Toy Story or Ice Age. It wasn't a complete animation, of course. It was based on real footage. But what I'm saying is you basically have to reassemble all of the frames of the film and essentially create 486 fake photographs. Now, creating fake photographs wasn't that difficult, even in 1863, let alone 1963. 486 of them that are consistent with the laws of physics is a bit of a tough challenge. You know, it's quite doable. It's quite possible. But... so you got those things. I mean, for my work, there's no, for my opinion, and anybody that, and it can be a bit hard to understand, but if you follow the arguments through, even without knowing, even without looking what's actually in the film, it either has to be all genuine or it has to be all created from other material. And then the second step was I found things that were actually impossible in the film. A couple of small mistakes that were made when the film was recreated, physical mistakes, so that, for example, the edge of the sign, the Stebbins Freeway sign, if it was genuine, then in real life it would have been straight, or it would have been in the same place in Dealey Plaza as the camera passed. But what happened was, because some early frames of the film were published showing the edges of the film straight, what hadn't been taken into account, that there's pin cushion distortion in the camera that Zapruder was supposed to have been using, when you take it into account, the sign looks like it flops around depending on which way you point the camera. So in other words, if you point the camera to the left of the sign, it leans one way, and you point the camera to the right of the sign, it leans the other way, but the sign isn't connected to the camera. That tells you that there's been a mistake in how they've recreated this film. It's very subtle, and actually that's why since I've last been on the show, some of the things, I haven't done as much work in more recent years, but some of the work I've done actually follows on from that and gets away from some of the physics. Because people look at this stuff, you know, lots of experts in the field, you know, even David Lifton looks at some of this material. In 2003, he said, look, you know, I don't follow all of this material necessarily. And you're looking at me now thinking, you know, I'm not sure about this because that's pretty deep physics.
No, well, I'll tell you, honestly, what I think is I don't have my mind made up about it. I'm just so interested to talk about it, though.
Yeah.
Because the idea of the show is I want other people to listen to you and make up their own mind. So I'm not trying to influence the conversation at all. So my first question was going to be, well, why would they recreate it then? And then I was thinking, is taking a film, like if you took these stills and you put them together and you take another, or you take a film of a film, is that what you mean by animation as well? But let's get back to the first question then. So if something's happened to the film, why would they have to recreate it?
Okay, well that comes down to the question of if the film was changed, what actually happened? Like what was the story before they changed the film? What did the original film look like? Or what did it actually look like within Dealey Plaza? So I'll come back to that in a moment after talking about the film. But that's actually a very interesting question, and it's quite a difficult one to answer, because if they've changed the films, then you've got no physical evidence showing you what happened. Like we've got no CCTV footage. We can't just look at what happened if they've actually altered those films. So it's quite interesting to figure out what actually did happen. But the reason why you would change the film is that something happened that you don't want to be known to the public. Now, whether that's something implying a conspiracy, whether it involves the people that actually planned the assassination, or it's after the fact that they said, we can't let that be known.
Such as the car stopping.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the big one. And I mean, David Lifton has an excellent presentation. He actually explained it better than me at that 2003 symposium, his presentation, that as the car slows down and stops, I mean, even though it's a very rapid stop, and then as it jumps out of the street, as one of the, I think the driver or the other Secret Service guy said, and then accelerates, if you actually measure how many frames would have to be taken out of a film to remove that stop and give the current version where the car smoothly just glides down the street and maybe slightly changes its speed, but it never comes to any jerking stop or rapid acceleration, there's a hell of a lot of frames that have to be taken out. So already we know that there must be wholesale editing. If the car came to a stop, or almost to a stop, and some people say it didn't come to a complete stop, it to me it doesn't really matter. You slam on the brakes, the people get jostled around. I don't care if it's a rolling stop, you know, when you come to a stop sign and you often don't actually stop.
Yeah.
I don't care which one it is. But what we've seen as a Zapruder film, nobody would ever describe that as a stop. I mean, I used to show it when I was a teacher, I used to show it to class fours of students, thousands of them. And, you know, sometimes I would say, did the car stop? And they said, and they only watched it once or twice or three times. And of course it didn't stop. Nobody that sees any of those films would say the car stops because it doesn't stop. Whereas eyewitnesses who actually, when you think about it, were further away, a lot of them.
Quite a few of them.
Were further away. And then some of them were very close. Dozens described the car coming to a stop or almost a complete stop.
Right.
So that's just one obvious thing. But, you know, obviously there's other things, there's other details of what might have happened that you want to remove from the photographic evidence. Now, you know, it's a sort of an inverse problem. How do you figure out what actually happened if you don't have that evidence anymore? But the car stopping is one. If there were two headshots, for example, if there were too many shots, and of course we've got evidence of even the surveyors that were using the frames of the Zapruder film to reconstruct, you know, where everything happened on the street, and they're talking about seeing blood and brain matter coming out the back of his head, which you would have if you had the original film.
Yeah,
of course, the version we've got now has been sanitized as well. If you notice, apart from frame 313, maybe frame 314, there's no blood or gore in the film. There's no blood on the limousine, on the trunk of the limousine. There's no blood. There's no material. There's nothing over anybody. There's a few roses in the car, which some people think at first might be blood. But basically, there's nothing that actually lets you figure out which direction the shots came from or even when they happened. So it seems from people that saw the film early on that the film was much more explicit and, in fact, would look much more like a film of somebody being shot or shot multiple times. What we have now is a sanitized version of the film. It's not quite PG-rated, but it's effectively, there's no gore except for that one frame 330.
They don't show it at the sixth floor museum because it may frighten children, right?
I was amazed going through the sixth floor museum. Yeah, and Jim Fetzer flew me there before I went to this symposium. And just to sort of validate some of my work and make sure that all of my measurements at Dealey Plaza agreed with the real plaza. And even somebody, I can't remember who lost their bet. I don't think it was Jim. But it was somebody that lost a bet that the angle of Elm Street wasn't 3 degrees. They said it's much steeper than that, and they said they'd eat their clothes if it was. Well, Jack White and I measured Elm Street, and it was exactly, you know, to within errors 3 degrees. And so somebody was supposed to be eating their clothes. But now the Sixth Floor Museum is a whole other story. It was actually interesting. I had some feedback that there's some people are quite upset at the moment because Rich De La Rosa actually. New Year's Day 2010, he actually shared some information with me about the other films that he saw. He basically said, I'm sick of being the person who of the things that happened because, you know, I've seen other films. Now, he's given an account, which some of which was actually published in the Great Spirit of Film Hoax, of what he saw, but he actually withheld some information so that if he actually saw those films again, he would recognize them. Mm-hmm. So, and it was almost like passing on the baton. He shared some of that with me, and I said I would keep that as control information. And I think there's some people that aren't too happy. I mentioned that on Simpkins Forum the other week. It was when Greg Burnham sort of commemorated the anniversary of Rich's passing. So
yeah.
That's something, you know, that I promised to do for him. And look, if there are aspects of the film, and I won't speak about it, I haven't seen it myself, but if I do see it, then I'll be able to give some indication of whether it is a similar addition to the one that Rich may have seen.
Right. Well, we're going to get back to your investigation of the authenticity of the film,
yep.
and things you found. But I am interested just if you just briefly go into your, since I haven't been there, your impression of the Sixth Floor Museum. I mean, if you read what Gary Mack writes on there, we do everything we can to make a level playing field, and without loading the question, what's your impression? You were there.
You haven't been to the Sixth Floor?
No, I would never give money.
Mausoleum?
Out of spite. Just, you know, I'm just admitting it. It's a failing, right? Like, the amount of letters I got about him, I have a boycott page, and just when they started, you know, they wouldn't handle anybody. They have Gerald Posner. I mean, everyone knows. I mean, we talked to Robert Groden many times, so we know the animosity between Gary Mack and the other research community, and we know the flip-flop he made once he's making $200,000 a year. So I have to admit I'm prejudiced about the whole idea. You know, I'm saying it's not fair, but I'm just giving you a chance to say, you know, you were there. What's your impression? Something you liked about it? Something you didn't like?
Oh, well, look, I mean, as I said, I was there in 2003, and I'm not sure what... I'm sure nothing much has changed since then. I haven't heard anybody say that they've suddenly had a Damascene conversion and they're showing more things now. But, I mean, the primary reason for me to go there, I mean, I was there, and also wanted to see what things looked like out of the... close to the sixth floor window. You can't get to the actual window, but you can get to the next window and just look down and think to yourself, would you have really taken a shot that way?
Just like in the movies you've seen it, right?
That's right. But when you're actually there and you're looking right down and you're looking at the car or cars coming up Houston Street, and you say to yourself, would you really have waited until he's going through the trees and he's almost hidden by the Secret Service agents?
Driving away,
So that's why. That's primarily why I went up there and paid whatever was the entry fee. But yeah, it's absolutely whitewashed. It's, you know, there's no books that give a contrary point of view. So it's not a level playing field. It's completely the, you know, the Warren Commission apologists' version. There's no contrary views that I saw there at all. The films, the Zapruder film, as you say, doesn't even show parts of it. It's all presented as if it's all, like, all the evidence is presented as if it's gospel truth, that this is exactly... And of course, there are researchers that believe that the Zapruder film is genuine and the Mormon Polaroid is genuine. But even there's no... None of the exhibits even give an indication that any of these things are disputed or that there's a controversy. So that's what... That's probably the most disappointing for something which puts the word museum at the end of its name.
Yeah, I called it ad nauseum.
Yeah,
and here's the problem. Among researchers that we would get together and say we have an honest interest, just show me where the chips fall. You know, am I right? Am I wrong about this? That's where I'm in that camp. And, you know, let's look into it. But when you get this kind of Mack and McAdams and all these other guys, Art Inspector, look, there's problems analyzing the evidence just to start with, without the fraud.
Yeah.
And as you go further, as we were just listening to Jim DiEugenio talk about, Lee Oswald is framed at every conceivable avenue.
Right.
And if you look into any of those things, they've been manufactured.
Absolutely.
So when I drag my feet about the Zapruder film, I remember the words of Jim Garrison saying, look, there's nothing these guys wouldn't do to frame this. You know, there's nothing they wouldn't do to distort, or, you know, and you know, you just have the list of Bellin, Art Inspector, Gerald Ford, we're going to change the bullet wound, we're going to change this, we're going to burn our autopsy notes. So,
well, I mean, that's an important point. And, of course, David Mantic did really groundbreaking work with the autopsy x-rays and showed that the piece of bone that was put into them and the x-rays that aren't even consistent. So it's one of those things where you don't assume that every piece of evidence is fabricated. I mean, I guess you'd have to assume, even though there's no chain of custody for half of it, most of it, you'd assume that it's genuine unless proven otherwise. But the fact is that just about in every case it's been proven that something's been done to every piece of it. The Zapruder film was a bit of a, you know, holy cow. It was taken as evidence of a shot from the front, that there was more than, it wasn't just Oswald shooting. And so, you know, you got to understand that, you know, Jim was talking about the first generation of researchers. It would be difficult if you've spent 10, 20, 30 years with the Zapruder film to then say, well, maybe that's been fiddled with as well. But everything should be open to question because there's no absolute chain of custody for any of these things.
Well, like he was saying, just the revolver. Is it a given that that was Lee Oswald's revolver? Is it a given that he actually had that gun?
Absolutely.
Did he get? And then you say, wait a minute, he couldn't have mailed that. I mean, he would have. Anyway, we'd have to get into that.
Yeah.
But
so, So, as I said, with the
Well, let me back up a little bit. Yeah. So, as you investigated early physical properties of the frames, the film frames, what was the first thing that caught your eye that you saw, well, there's something wrong here?
Well, it's funny, actually, because what I started off with, I had the book Assassination Science, which had been criticized by some people, and, you know, those who believed in alteration thought it was, you know, had a lot of good evidence. I was actually going through a lot of the arguments that David Mantic had put for the Zapruder film, and I was actually proving a lot of them to be wrong. I was saying, actually, if you do this, it's actually, David, unfortunately, is not correct. And then I'd get another piece and I'd say, well, that's not correct either. And the interesting thing is that every time I showed that one of his arguments was wrong, David Mantic would come back and say, that's fantastic, that you've done great work. Which, and he's a physicist, so that's what you do when you're genuine and somebody has shown. And, you know, as long as their argument is genuine, you acknowledge when you make a mistake.
Yeah.
As I did later with the Mary Moorman Polaroid, you acknowledge when you make a mistake. And the same thing with Jim Fetzer, who was the editor of the book. And, you know, that's what led to me being invited to this symposium. At that stage that he originally invited me, I was actually proving all of the alteration proofs to be wrong. But then the thing that really grabbed my eye as being very strange is I'd stabilized the frames that show Jean Hill, you know, the lady in the red overcoat,
right,
standing in the background. And I'd read descriptions of what, you know, she was jumping up and down and calling Mr. President, come over here and so on, let us get your picture. When you actually look in the Zapruder film, and if you put her in the middle and stabilize it so she doesn't move, like the car's moving but the background is not moving, then what you find is that she's almost like a statue. She's standing there with her hands clasped in front of her, and all that moves is her head the whole time that the car goes past, which is a very strange thing for anybody watching the president, especially somebody that said straight afterwards, she was on radio and she got totally lambasted for saying there was a dog in the street, when I think she meant to say a dog in the seat, and she'd seen that little puppet thing, right?
Right, yeah.
That was that radio interview. But even at that stage, she was describing, straight after the assassination, being animated and calling to the president. For her to appear there as if she was a stuffed doll and only her head was moving, that looked strange. So that wasn't a proof. I mean, because people can stand there very...
But that's what made you start thinking.
That's what made me start thinking. And this is at the stage that I was on the Lancer forum, and Tink Thompson was praising my work of saying that the film was either all genuine or, you know, you'd have to alter every frame. So that was that. Then that's when I then got into some of the more subtle aspects, like the sign and the lamppost not being stuck into the film correctly. And the reason it couldn't be changed is because that was published within a couple of days of the assassination, that first issue of Life. Had a couple of pictures of the Stemmen sign,
right,
and of the lamppost, and once you've published it to millions of Americans and other people around the world, you can't get the toothpaste back into the tube, right? So most of the film is technically almost perfect. I mean, you know, you can have a dozen PhDs in physics with experts in photogrammetry go through it, and just about everything is perfect. But there's a couple of things where early mistakes were made, and no matter what you do, you can try and fudge over it, but you can't actually undo it. I mean, it's out there. As I said, and it was also in terms of the blur, one of the frames published was so clear, the foreground and the background were clear, which can't work with Zapruder's camera, because Zapruder's camera is, the shutter is open nearly half of the time. And so even if you're perfectly panning with the limousine, the background is blurring because the camera's moving. So to have a frame in Life magazine where the background is sharp and the limousine is sharp, you can actually measure it and show that that's actually impossible. It can't have come from the Zapruder camera. And that's when, you know, that's another indication that everything has started to unravel. But as I said, after that and the book that came out, and, you know, there's people that have criticized it, and, you know, there are people that refuse to even describe the mathematics of the alternative, you know, like Craig Lampson, who insists on attacking me wherever I might make a comment somewhere, and he's quite hilarious, because every time I ask him the same question about perspective transformations, and every time he just goes on and you know, has a sook and says, well, I'm not going to answer the questions about mathematics, you tell me something else, right? So, but essentially that work was done, and there's not much more that I think I could have found from the physical side of things. I did, in 2006, I did actually reprocess the frames and do it a slightly better way, and that's the one that most people use, set of frames that they use on the internet. But I also created some stabilized video clips. There's one of them that pans with the limousine all the way from frame 133 after the splice when you first see the limo, all the way to the end of the film. And it's important that it goes all the way to the very end. And there's also another set of sequences where you actually keep the background stable and the film sort of pans across the view. And they're all on my website as well. So when you put the link there, people can find them quite
good.
Easily.
Okay, good. So people can find this work there.
All of the things I'm describing, you can find through my website and into the JFK page of my website. But after I did that work with the frames, what I actually have been concentrating on for the little bit of work I've been doing on it in the last few years is actually, okay, we have these films that must have been altered because we know that this one's fake, the other ones are consistent with it, so they must have all been fabricated to be consistent with each other. And the Zapruder film technically is the hardest one. That's the master film that actually takes the most work to fabricate. So let's just assume that we can't trust all of the photographic evidence. Some of it might be genuine, right? I've got my own opinions as to which photographs are genuine and which ones aren't. Especially, you know, ones that people are ascribed of taking and they vehemently deny ever taking. But let's just say that we can't trust all of the photographic evidence. If you were a lawyer, you know, if Oswald hadn't been knocked off and it actually went to a real trial and you had to have real standards of evidence, how would you determine what actually happened in Dealey Plaza? Well, how do you determine what happens with many crimes, except today in 7-Elevens where you've got video cameras? You have witnesses, you have testimony, you know, you have people describe what happened. Because in most cases, you don't have video of crimes, okay? So let's just pretend we don't have any photographs, we don't have any videos, it wasn't a special event with the President of the United States. Let's see what the people actually said. So one of the things I did, I think it was 2006 or 2007, I went through a list of all the testimony that Stuart Gallinor had taken from Warren Commission volumes, and he'd actually compiled it so that to answer two different questions. One was, how many shots were there? And secondly, what direction did they come from? And, you know, based on basically all of the information in the Warren Commission volumes themselves, if you took all those affidavits and all those statements, how could you answer those questions? Now, that was the point of his study. What I did was I used that same collection of materials that he'd collected so nicely on the History Matters archive, and I said, okay, I'm not going to answer those two questions. I'm going to leave that to, you know, the number of shots and the direction, leave that to one side. What else can you gather from that happened in Dealey Plaza from what the eyewitnesses said? And I basically had a criterion that at least two independent people, so not husband and wife, but two independent people had to have described the same general feature before I'd put it in my compilation.
Right, okay.
And I compiled that, and it's like 100 pages long. It's on assassination research, but it's also linked from my website. And there's some interesting things. I mean, of course, there are some features of it are exactly what we see in the film. But there are other aspects of it that if you just listen to what the people actually said, it doesn't agree with what's in the film. And in a lot of cases, for decades, researchers would assume, the witnesses were just wrong because we know what happened. We're looking at the film. We can see what happened and actually what they're describing didn't happen. But today we've got to take it back and say, let's even assume there's some doubt about the authenticity of the photographic evidence and listen to what the people that were there are actually telling us, even in the words of the people that reported for the Warren Commission, the sheriffs, the police, the Warren Commission, the commissioners themselves that are questioning these people. And you get a very different picture. Of course, one of the famous ones is the limousine stop, and that's been well documented going back decades, that there's, you know, dozens of witnesses saying that the limo stopped or it almost stopped. It came to a sudden halt.
Right.
But there's other things about
even in Oliver Stone's film, he made a point of showing the brake lights coming on, right? You know, like, and other witnesses, I don't know why that car stopped. I mean, he should have, you know.
It's well documented. And I think in Murder in Dealey Plaza, was it Vince Palomara that did the study? But I apologize at this stage. I haven't looked at it for a while. But there's more comprehensive studies of how many dozen witnesses said that the car came to a stop or almost to a stop, which, of course, is what you don't see in the film. There's some other subtle things like what JFK actually does when he gets first shot or even when he gets first shot. In the Zapruder film, when you look at it, when he gets shot in the throat, his elbows come up, and I call it the chicken dance. It's a very strange reaction to someone that's been shot in the throat. You would have think someone would go like that, if you're on a webcam, you can see that. You would have think someone would just grasp for their throat. They wouldn't put their elbows up. And I call it the chicken dance. The interesting thing is that there's no description from any witness, even people in the car, outside the car, in front of the car, behind the car, that he did that strange chicken dance sort of move. Time after time, they describe him as slumping and slumping to the left after the first shot and not doing this hunching and putting his elbows up. So already we've got some indications that something strange is happening. And of course, there's also the number of shots, as I said, I wasn't looking at. But one of the things that came out of that I think Jim Fetzer described well a few years ago, I think he put an article out on it, was that the people in the lead limousine, so we're talking about Forrest Sorrells and Chief Curry, and I can't remember who else was there, but the people in the lead limousine, the lead car, all described in multiple places and testified to the Warren Commission themselves that James Cheney, motorcycle rider, went past the presidential limousine, came up to them and yelled at and basically told them that something was bad, that the president had been shot or get us to a hospital or something like that. Like there's one, two, three of them, four of them all say the same thing. It's a fairly trivial thing. I mean, you wouldn't think it'd be controversial that a motorcycle cop came up to the leaders, you know, the government leaders effectively. In the motorcade and said, we've got serious trouble, we need to get to a hospital straight away. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the Nix film, which shows the complete period from when the limousine, when you see the headshot, all of the motorcycles actually slow down and stop. The presidential limousine keeps going, and no motorcycle ever passes the limousine. And the Nix film, if it had actually happened, the Nix film would show it. Now, the Zapruder film is consistent with the Nix film. If it happened, the Zapruder film should show it. It would actually be down in the what I call the ghost panels. It's a little bit more subtle, so I use the Nix film as the best example. But also, the Zapruder film doesn't show a motorcycle on the near side passing the limousine and going to the lead car and yelling at them and describing that he's been shot, as they all said that he did. And in fact, one of the other motorcycle cops, I think, quotes Jim Cheney as saying he did it himself. It's a totally undisputed fact. But
we're going to need an opener.
We've got refills. Good. The stories will get better as the beers continue. So it would seem like a totally trivial fact until you look at the Nix film and the Zapruder film and you realise, hang on, this whole incident of Jim Cheney driving forward and saying that he's been shot has actually been deleted from the film. Now, you don't need a PhD in nuclear physics to see that in the Nix film. You just have to look at the Nix film. And then you look at what Forrest Sorrells and other people said and you say to yourself, hang on, that's not there. So do you believe all these people that independently stated the same thing multiple times?
Now, of course, my first thought is that could have this happened further down the line? Like, you know,
not a
mile or two, like pandemonium breaking out in the plaza, and then motorcycle cop, okay, they speed up, they catch up with them later on.
Yeah, well, that would be a good argument if it was fairly vague, but if you actually read...
Well, it is vague. I'm saying I don't know. That's my first
thought.
Yeah,
no, I mean, if they basically describe something that didn't have an event attached to it, then you might say, okay, it could have happened when they were down near the actual Stemmons Freeway, when they're out of the plaza, they'd gone through the triple underpass. But when you actually read the descriptions, so, you know, in some cases they're actual statements of what happened step by step, made just days after, or on the day of the assassination, or days after the assassination. They describe Jim Cheney coming forward, and then they describe the limousine accelerating, and then they describe leaving Dealey Plaza. So it's quite unequivocal. Now, I'm not saying every statement is like that, but basically most of them are like
that. No, that's fine. You know, I just wanted to...
And look, I mean, everybody's got to read it themselves and come to their own conclusion, but, you know, it's... You can read it there from the eyewitness statements, and then you can look at the Nix film when there's a Zapruder film.
Now, how many eyewitness statements would you say have a conflict with the film?
What I basically did was to put them together. So, like, you know, if they've got dozens of people saying the same thing about the president slumping, mm-hmm. or even things that didn't happen. Like, there's not many... I think there might have only been one person that actually describes Jackie Kennedy crawling all the way out on the back of the trunk of the limousine. Which is an interesting thing. It comes to the second thing, if you like, that I've been doing with the eyewitness statements.
Right.
But it's got another twist, and it's only just happened in the last year. Well, it's come to a head in the last year. So what actually happens after the shots is interesting, but still within Dealey Plaza.
Okay.
Because, you know, I used to show the Zapruder film to my school students, you know, and I would say, you know, there's, watch out, there's violence, but it's all a fake film. It's just based on a true story. So it's not really a real film, so you shouldn't get too upset if you see JFK being killed, because it's not genuine blood and gore. In fact, you don't see much blood and gore. So there's two universal reactions that anybody has when they see the Zapruder film for the first time. One is that when he gets shot, when he appears to get shot in the head, everyone groans. It's like, it's pretty shocking.
Right.
The second thing is, after it stops, there's always somebody that puts up their hand and says, what was that woman doing crawling out on the back? Mm-hmm. Right? It's the main thing that draws your attention, okay, as the car continues to roll out of Dealey Plaza. And then she sort of crawls, and then Clint Hill sort of gets up on the back, and it's a bit, the film's shaking, it's going through the bushes, you can't see what's going on. Somehow she ends up back in the car, and most of the time, like, if you look at Robert Grodin's stabilizations, he stops before you get anywhere near the exit from Dealey Plaza. I mean, the main action, you want to see what happens around the time of the shots. Once it gets up to frame 330, because that's where the Warren Commission stopped with their exhibit in volume 18, they stopped around frame 330. Right, the film goes to frame 486. So there's 150 frames that doesn't get much attention most of the time, especially as a moving picture. So if you put it all back together and stabilize it, and so the limousine is stable, which is quite difficult to do because it's getting smaller and it's going through bushes and so on. But if you do that, then there's an interesting thing that you notice, and that is that according to the Zapruder film, Clint Hill runs up to the limousine, and it's quite a fast run, because remember, in the Zapruder film, there's no limousine stop. It continues to move, so Clint Hill has to really sprint to get up to it. Then he jumps up, he slips off, and he gets on. But if you keep following the film, what you see is that he never gets further than hanging onto the back handhold. You know, there's a foothold on the
right.
On the back left,
yeah.
And there's a handhold.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
If you actually watch him all the way to the end of the film, where it goes through the triple underpass and passes the lead car, according to the Zapruder film, Clint Hill never got further than that position within Dealey Plaza. He never climbed over the trunk. He never got into the back seat. He never, you know, got anywhere near the president. Now, later on, of course, if they stopped, then he would have had a chance, and we've seen photographs of him on the Stemmons Freeway actually inside with his foot hanging out. But if you look at the Zapruder film, within Dealey Plaza, he didn't do that. Now, the interesting thing is that Clint Hill himself has given a number of interviews over the years. There was one in 75, there was one in the 90s, and then there was, and this is what brought it to a head, most recently with this book tour that's going on about the Secret Service book,
right.
He's been on tour as well. And in one of the interviews, that the book, one of the book signings, he actually gave a sort of a full account of what happened on that day again. And the interesting thing is, from the statements he made, like the official statement he typed up and submitted within days of the assassination, through to 1975, through to the 1990s, through to 2010, he was adamant in each case that after the shots, he got to the limousine, he climbed over the trunk, he pushed Jackie back down into the seat, he could see into the president's head, there was a piece of his skull sitting on the back of the seat, and that he covered them with his body, and then the car accelerated, left Dealey Plaza, and, you know, he signaled behind him, you know, gave a thumbs down to the guys behind him saying things are bad, because he'd actually seen the president. Now, he's been adamant, consistent, you would say. This is something which is obviously burned into his...
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, how could you... You know, that whole movie, In the Line of Fire, was about, you know, Clint Eastwood was playing Clint Hill, basically,
yeah.
Living with the trauma of this thing. So for 47 years, his story has been consistent about what he did in those instants after the shots. Okay, did he react too late? Could he have got there sooner? Let's forget about that, but about pushing Jackie down. So the interesting thing is, you've got the Zapruder film that says, Clint Hill, you're a liar. Or you've got Clint Hill saying, Zapruder film, you're a liar. One of them has to be false. Now, people have opinions about the Secret Service. I actually believe, for whatever else he might have thought about other things, for whatever else the Secret Service might have said about the events that may or may not be true, I believe that what Clint Hill said is probably right. Because if the limousine did stop, he would have had plenty of time to get in the car and push her back down in the seat and cover her, because he was a Secret Service agent. That's what they do. You know, when Reagan was shot, they cover him. They pull him into the car, they cover him over. Now, if he had another 3 or 4 seconds where the limousine had stopped or almost stopped, then it jumped out of the street, as William Greer said, like that, you know, just planted the accelerator down, jumped out of the street, everyone was shaken, and the car zooms off out of the plaza, there was enough time for him to do those things. It's consistent to me. Now, you know, without seeing a genuine film of what actually happened, we'll never know. But I actually suspect that Clint Hill is telling the truth. And the Zapruder film, of course, we already know the Zapruder film was a lie, so it would be no surprise to me that the Zapruder film is lying. Now, Jim Fetzer has written up a very, very good article about this on his blog site, I believe, in a couple of months ago, and well, in the last month or two, because of this book signing that's been going on for the Secret Service book. I can't remember the author.
There's two, isn't it? Two guys that were...
Yeah, I can't exactly... See, because I'd gotten the thing sent through. He'd sent it through about the book and the book tour and the video that was out, and I ignored everything about the book. I was just fascinated by Clint Hill describing again what he had described. I mean, it was actually so strong what he'd already described in previous years that about 5 years ago I actually sent Clint Hill a letter and said... And he got it because I've got the registered receipt. I've got his signature at home on the receipt that he received the letter. And all I said to him is, look, you know, I know that you must know that what's in the Zapruder film is not what happened on that day, that you did push Jackie down and you did cover them and you did at least do that part of your job, however much you're beating yourself up about whether you could have reacted quicker or not, right? And what I basically said to him is, make sure that for posterity that some record of what actually happened is kept somewhere. So it was actually bizarre for me to see that he's gone out in his book tour still describing exactly what he's stuck to for 47 years, but he must know that it's inconsistent with what is shown in the Zapruder film and also the part of the Nixon film that covers that same footage. So look, it's not physical proof. I mean, now we're talking about people. Now we're talking about eyewitnesses and what they said and what they saw and what they did. But actually, in a court of law, that carries more weight than a set of 486 photographs because, you know, the Zapruder film would only be entered into evidence in a court of law, one, if it had a chain of custody, and two, if somebody would testify to its authenticity, that I took this film. This was a film taken on November 22nd, 1963, and Abraham Zapruder should be the person to testify, to even make the Zapruder film admissible in a court of law. Of course, in the Jim Garrison trial, he had trouble even recognizing his own film or features of his own film. I mean, he thought that he'd filmed as the limousine turned the corner. Now, there are questions about whether Zapruder was even taking the film, because other photographs that should show Zapruder, you know, show something that's not right, or Zapruder with Sitzman behind him. Jack White has done a lot of work over the years, and you know, other people have, like Jones Harris, have pointed out this thing as well, that the guy is far too short and, you know, he doesn't appear to be holding a camera, and there is no clear photograph showing Zapruder filming the Zapruder film. But let's leave that to one side. Let's pretend that he did take the film. He basically couldn't recognise his own film in the Garrison trial and be able to authenticate it, which is fair enough because he basically gave over control.
Do you recall some of those problems that you say you had trouble?
Oh well, but particularly the one that got me was that he got the film as the car was turning the corner. But also his description, even to the Warren Commission, that JFK was clutching his chest. If anybody saw the chicken dance, the elbows up, that's on the Zapruder film, it should have been Zapruder because he had the same point of view as his camera. You would think if he was there. The other problem with the Zapruder, though, actually taking the Zapruder film is...
Well, he watched it. Didn't they see it like 3 times in a row?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, was Zapruder actually describing what he saw live, or was he describing what he saw when they showed him his film, or maybe what had been done to his film? There was one problem with that. It was actually an interesting thing as well. Back in 2003, when the Zapruder film symposium was on, one of the things that Zapruder actually said in his testimony was that he had a clearer view of the assassination because he was looking through the viewfinder. And, you know, when you look through the viewfinder, you can, you know, with a camera, you can use a camera as a telescope, right? So you're looking through the viewfinder. You read that testimony and you assume, okay, you know, we see these beautiful, big, clear blow-ups of the Zapruder film. We assume that that's what Zapruder saw through the viewfinder because he actually says, you know, I had a clearer view because I was looking through the viewfinder. Now, there's two problems with that. One, there's a photograph showing him taking the Zapruder film where he isn't even holding the camera up to his eye properly, and it's a bit difficult to know how he would do it because he had these thick glasses on, spectacles on. But the second problem is that if you actually get the Zapruder model camera, and I did this when I was sitting in Jim Fetz's lounge room back in 2003, Rick Janowitz, I think, or David Healy had brought the same model camera. And I looked through the viewfinder on the full telephoto zoom mode at, I think I was looking at David Healy on the other side of the lounge room, and I took it away and then looked through it again and took it away, and I realised that there's actually no magnification through the viewfinder. So he would have only seen from back on that pedestal exactly what he would have seen with the naked eye anyway. So that, you know, I mean, if you were trying to criticise, if it was a real court of law and Oswald had a defence lawyer, you were trying to discredit the witness about this particular film, not only doesn't he have the chain of custody, but also there are things that he described with the film and confusion about what it shows that, you know, you'd have to have real doubts. Any jury would have to have doubts that he really, you know, that this was actually the same film. And of course, the other part of this is that there are people, you know, people describe, like I said, the surveyors describe what they saw on the Zapruder film in the early days, things that are no longer there, like the blood and gore, the multiple shots, which are no longer visible.
Was it Homer McMahon?
Yeah, Homer McMahon. That was a very interesting one, of course, and you know, I've published my opinion of Doug Horne's book on the, or part of a book on the Zapruder film, in the his work on the film evidence in his five volumes, you know, Homer McMahon's description, and Jim Fetz has made this point, you know, frequently over the last 10 or 15 years, that Homer McMahon, who was an expert trick shooter, if you actually listen to the interview with Homer McMahon, there's a copy of it on my website as well, then he actually describes how he was a trick shooter. Like, he knew guns, he knew shots, he knew, like, he could do these fancy tricks where you could shoot three things out of the sky and all that sort of thing. And he said he could see 6 to 8 shots from three different directions. 6 to 8 hits. Okay, now nobody that looks at the film today, you know, even if you look at it 1,000 times frame by frame, there's one shot that's pretty clear, and that's frame 313. Right. There's nothing else that's very clear. So immediately you say to yourself, something has changed between what these people saw in the first couple of weeks and what we now have today, because, you know, there's great debate. Even the Life magazine article that described the 8mm film taken of the assassination has all these very strange references. And this is from Life magazine, who apparently had the original film. So, you know, it says the Paul Mandel article. And again, David Lifton makes note of this in his chapter in the book as well. But that, you know, the JFK was turning far to the right when he got shot in the throat. You know, that you see that doesn't actually appear in the film that we have now. They have actual frame numbers they have frame differences between where the shots were fired. And when you work back from frame 313, which is the obvious one, and use those frame numbers that are in this Life magazine article, only, you know, a week after the assassination, you look on the film as we now have it, and there's absolutely nothing there. In fact, if you had to take a guess, and when people have taken a guess at where the shots have happened, they would not pick the frame numbers you get when you work backwards from this Life magazine article. So you get this feeling that the Zapruder film was a work in progress, that it might have had some quick editing done to it by optical, like Hollywood-type film techniques that are very quick, the sort of things David Healy described at the Duluth Symposium and in the book. But then the actual frames were created like fake photographs, you know, like you can have a photograph of Hitler dancing the jig and all those sort of things. That sort of work was not too difficult to do. It just took a bit of effort. But even Dan Rather, who's been, you know, totally slammed for his descriptions and viewpoints and whatever, he, you know, runs back and describes, you know, Zapruder falling, JFK falling forwards, right? And for decades, people, you know, were saying, you know, he's obviously a liar, because now we have the Zapruder film and he goes violently backwards. But if you look at what the actual eyewitnesses say, going back to the eyewitness compilation, there's nobody that describes the back and to the left that was actually there. Almost all of them say that he slumped. Okay? So, or that he slumped to the left, or maybe even slumped forward, which, you know, because when you get shot in the head, it blows things out the back. You don't necessarily have to go back and to the left. So it may well be that Dan Rather was actually describing honestly what he saw in an early version of the film, for whatever else you think of him and whatever other things he said and done in this case.
So anyway, that's just another thought, an idea, food for thought.
Well, that's right. I mean, we don't actually know. We have evidence that the film's been altered. We don't actually know what earlier versions of the film looked like, or even what the real film or films. And of course, there's another part of this, is if you do create a fake Zapruder film with a level of detail that is on the Zapruder film, that some of the work that I've done, and I think this is beyond dispute on both sides of the fence, if you were to create a fake Zapruder film, you cannot do it from just an original Zapruder film. You need more footage. You actually need, you need some sort of footage or photographs of above the Zapruder film and below the Zapruder film, because of the way that the images between the sprocket holes get exposed. It's a bit technical, but essentially, if you look at the physics of it, to create a fake Zapruder film with all the properties that the one we now have has, you needed more than one film. So that's an interesting point in itself. At the least, you would need a pilot film of what Dealey Plaza looked like from the Zapruder pedestal, where he was supposed to have stood. And then on top of that, you could paste in real footage. Because obviously you're not going to go and animate, you know, you're not going to animate the whole Zapruder film. You can't make it out of nothing. But you can cut out, you know, little pictures of the limousine as it moves down the street and it gets bigger, and you can get the right perspective on the limousine and the people within the limousine. But you can then, you know, move them around and paste things together. And if you do this in a very large format, by the time you then re-photograph it through as a prototype camera onto the 8mm film, then basically the grain size of the film, you know, any cut marks that you might have seen if the thing was, you know, as big as holding out your arms, when you shrink it back down, you don't see any lines because the film does not have that resolution anymore.
Was it 36 by 48?
Yeah, you could, or in whatever format was used to work on these things, once you get your 486 new frames, you can shrink it down, right? But actually creating those frames was quite complicated. It wasn't just a quick editing job. There was a lot of physics that went into it, and so the people that did it would have had to be experts in, you know, photogrammetry and physics and optics.
Well, people will have to go to your website to get full detail. One thing that's always interested me is that the sign, the Stemmons Freeway sign, was taken down and then replaced the next day, or I'm not sure if it was moved, but there's talk that the Dallas, I can't think of the right word for him, but street detail, had taken that sign down and replaced it.
That's a very interesting aspect of this whole thing, that to this day there's no clear story, like there's even no official story about what happened to that Stemmons Freeway sign. Okay, and there is talk that it was taken down and put back up. There was, you know, there was the groundskeeper Hudson was saying in his testimony to the Warren Commission that, you know, they moved some other sign and they put up a new Stemmons sign. There's all this confusion about, you know, whether it was moved or not. And my thoughts of, and so there's no actual answer as to what actually happened to the sign. Like, we don't really know if the Stemmons Freeway sign was just there and it stayed there for the next however long it was before they took it away, or whether it was taken down, a new one put up. But I suspect that the reason that it might have been, that things might have been done to it, or that at least these stories that things might have been done to it have been propagated, is because one of the proofs, one of the physical proofs of the alteration of the Zapruder film is the Stemmons Freeway sign not having the right properties. And depending on what you measure, you can sort of fudge over those proofs by saying, oh, no, but they took it down, and by the time they took these other photographs 4 days later, it was in a different position or on a different angle. You know, even by a few degrees would make a difference to some of these arguments. But the actual evidence that I found that's described in the presentations and the book and on my website is fairly technical details, but it actually doesn't rely on the sign, on images of the sign after the assassination. It's all just on what the sign looked like during the assassination. And that in itself, the sign is inconsistent from frame 192 to frame 220, for example. You don't have to rely on what the sign looked like 3 days later or 1 day later. It's actually inconsistent within the Zapruder film. It's self-inconsistent within the film. You don't have to rely on anything else. But I suspect the stories about the sign being moved or maybe even the reality of the sign being moved, it doesn't matter which, have to do with the fact that whoever was altering this photographic evidence in this massive way, for whatever reason, must have been aware that the Stemmons Freeway sign, that mistakes were made when they published those early frames in Life magazine. And some, yeah, because the people that were experts in this photogrammetry would have probably picked it up fairly quickly and we've done something wrong. And so I think that's generated either the real movement of the sign or the stories that the sign was moved to try and muddy the waters, you know, for the next 47 years. So we don't really know. But as I said, the actual proof doesn't rely on whether it was moved.
Well, my thought is, you know, just looking at it at arm's length, as something happened to the sign, that either the sign plays a role in telemetry, as you say, of anchoring yourself to where things are, or there's a bullet hole or something like that through it.
Yeah, well, I mean,
why would they even contemplate that? And that comes from the statement of the groundskeeper that it was moved?
He said that they moved. Well, actually, he said that they moved. I think he said they moved the Thornton side and they put up a Stemmons Freeway sign, right? So, I mean, one of the things that interested me when I started in this stuff, you know, 10 years ago, was how many photographs do we actually have of the Stemmons Freeway sign around the time of the assassination? I mean, I don't know if any from before the assassination, but you know, I don't know if anybody does. But it's actually quite interesting. A lot of the photographs and a lot of the films that we have often stop just before you would see the Stemmons Freeway sign, or they start just after you would see the Stemmons Freeway sign. There are a few that show it, and there's a few quite perplexing ones, but there's not many different photographs that show exactly where it was, because the more photographs you have of it from the more directions, then the more precisely you can actually recreate its position in space. So you can sort of, it seems that everything to do with the Stemmons Freeway sign, the least amount of information about it has been allowed to remain as possible, because I think it was recognized that whoever was altering this, the photographic evidence, the films, would have quickly realized that the sign was a real blunder. I mean, I call it one of the blunders of the century in terms of, you know, the hoax of the century being the Zapruder film, from my point of view. So, you know, look, that's my opinion. That's just my gut feeling. That's not scientific evidence of anything. But, you know, when you look at all of the evidence for enough years, there's certain impressions that come to you, and it just seems surprising that so many of the other films stop just before you could get a good fix on, okay, this is where the sign was. Just an interesting observation, but, you know, by itself doesn't mean anything. But you're definitely right. There's something going on with the Stemmons sign. Yeah, we know that.
Yeah.
Even the panels, if you look at the Stemmons sign in the...
These things add up to a mystery, right?
Yeah.
That's why people are interested still. And one thing that has interested me, no matter what side on the fence you're on, it's not Lee Oswald.
No.
You know, no matter what it is, are you saying that's a conspiracy of the intelligence agencies? Who would be in charge of those kind of things? Who would make a call to say that we've got to move the sign, or we've got to take it down?
Take it down,
put a new one up.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of the film evidence, you know, you obviously can't have a scenario where, you know, the mob did everything, because how would the mob get control of the films and collect them?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
we know the FBI...
do anything.
No, I mean, there's certain things they can do, but they can't do that. So, I mean, it's difficult. You know, I'm no expert on the question of what was done, who was planning what was planned ahead of time, and what was covered up afterwards. I mean, it's clear that there's a lot of things that happened in the cover-up that you can understand could have been manipulated into doing, you know, the World War III argument, for example. If there was evidence of a conspiracy, many people could have been involved in covering up, altering some of this evidence, simply to avoid that had nothing to do with the assassination except for covering it up.
As example, Earl Warren.
Yeah.
So nobody thinks he's a conspirator, yet when you hear that he was bullied into accepting that role by Johnson, as supporting your argument, yeah, I mean, doesn't mean he's a conspirator, but he's going along for the ride because he's been told, you know, missiles will be launched, millions of people will be killed, and we're just going to cover this up. We're going to sell it as a lone guy, and that's what I want you to do.
Yeah, and I think people people misunderstand that, because whenever, you know, you're talking, you know, how could you alter this evidence, that evidence, and so on, and they say, you know, surely you couldn't have had 40,000 people all involved in a conspiracy to murder the president, and that's not the point. The cover-up is totally different from who actually, you know, who actually created the hit in the first place. You know, even if it was just two guys that went out with guns and decided to kill him.
But you said two. Now, that's what the House Select Committee in 1978 said.
That's right, but that's...
Two.
Yeah, even if you went to that minimal level of conspiracy and saying, let's just pretend it was two guys that happened to just get together and go down and buy some guns.
But, or not to get together. I think that the Washington Post was saying, so what if somebody was shooting at him the same time Lee Oswald was?
Oh, yeah.
Lee hit him and this other guy, you know...
It's coincidence. Yeah, no, I mean, but even if you go to that level, it doesn't... They're two completely separate questions as to who set this up is separate from what was done to alter the evidence afterwards to cover up whatever was incriminating or whatever was dangerous, whatever, you know, it's two totally separate
right,
questions.
Right, and we could take it a step further. Like you mentioned, the film is altered or it isn't. And if it is, then what does that mean? That doesn't mean everyone in the government was behind that, but it means that at key positions, people who were just overjoyed, Hoover, you know, LBJ, all these people said, this is fucking great, you know. We got rid of the guy. We all hated him. Somebody said, you know, like that old thing that King Henry or whatever said, who will rid me of this man, right? So some guy said, okay. And in my case, I think that Ed Lansdale was behind that. Doesn't mean he's a gunman or anything. But, I mean, somebody has to be beside organizing people. And when you read the Chicago plot, when you hear of that, Miami, I mean, Chicago is almost a blueprint for Dallas, right? Hmm. And Lee Oswald set up. They kill him. You talk about every other area of the evidence that has been manipulated. Medical evidence, x-rays, so it isn't unreasonable to think that the photographic evidence would have been doctored or toyed with or, I don't want to use too strong a word, but anyone interested in your work can find your website. I'll make the links and look into it further. And, of course, Jim Fetzer has done his book, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax. So in the research community, there's people agree or don't agree. And people like the early work of Jack White now. Some people, you know, it's kind of funny that there isn't anyone really accepted as an authority to say, listen, community, the flag is going here. We're going to accept this, right? You know, so there is just a constant discussion. And hopefully the best evidence will rise to the top as, listen, of the things that we should draw a conclusion to, here are some of the things we have to draw a conclusion to. You know, and Jim Fetzer had the 16 smoking guns,
yeah.
Right? You know, so that's a start. Your work, others' work is all of interest.
Well, I mean, with my stuff, you know, as you say, there's a lot of different viewpoints out there, and there are some schools of thought, you know, like alteration of the films or not. There are certain schools that people have an opinion one way or the other. You know, there might be variations within that, but across the whole thing, everyone's got a different opinion. And you know, I've simply, you know, called it as I see it. I've had nothing to profit from this. I got a trip to the Sixth Floor Museum.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And up to Duluth to give this presentation and back to Melbourne all within a week. So, you know, if that's profiting from it, you know, I'm sure the jet lag took away that advantage.
Now, let me ask you this. I heard that, I don't know this, okay, Jim DiEugenio said at Lancer this year, I think there's people that that are working with David Lifton, but they're from, for lack of a better word, Hollywood, people from the Motion Picture Association have been looking at some frames and giving details of why they feel that there's been alteration to various frames. Are you familiar with that? Do you know what I'm speaking of? Because if you're not, no problem.
No, I don't know about that. The only thing was there was something in Doug Horn's book about...
Right. Doug Horn was making alluding to that as well.
Yeah,
well,
there's some descriptions
there. But they
hadn't
come out. I think it's an ongoing investigation.
Yeah, it was pretty. It seemed to be pretty late in the piece before his book came out. And my criticism of that was that, you know, it that sort of stuff you can't really include at the last moment, especially when you have five volumes, you know, dedicated to the assassination. You really can't just include some last-minute material. But I'll be very interested to see, you know, what these people have and what they've found. But it has to be, you know, put through the same sort of scrutiny. But I don't know anything about what you're saying with David.
Fair enough, right? Yeah. It's just of interest.
Yeah.
So even if I don't, you know, I'm just saying I'm dragging my feet on it. You know, like as I'm talking to you, I'm very interested. I'm sure other people listening are interested. They want to hear what are people finding out.
Right. Yeah.
So,
well, actually, it's interesting listening to the Wikipedia, the Wikigander, whatever you want to call it. And of course, about 12 months ago, I did a lot of work with ClimateGate emails, and it was quite interesting. In terms of global warming, there was a guy that was doing a lot of manipulation of Wikipedia in terms of the global warming pages. Anything to do with, you know, thousands of pages changed or deleted. So, I mean, Wikipedia is a strange beast. It's the sort of thing where you can trust it for things that are not in dispute, you know, like what's the population of Vancouver?
Yeah, or things that you want to agree with.
Yeah, yeah.
Things that you find uncomfortable. Yeah.
But anything with a political spin to them, you really, you know, have to treat it.
Have you seen Jesse Ventura's episode on global warming?
I don't think I've seen
it. Oh, I recommend it. You've got to watch it because he has a team of investigators and, okay, it's made for TV. But it's the same thing. It's like, look, if I'm so wrong, here, go out and interview these people and prove me wrong. You know, and that's what he's talking about, the climate gate things that, you know, okay, if the Earth is warming or not, just prove it. Because when you start to get in these carbon taxes and carbon and trading carbon credits and all that, it's a whole scheme. It's a pyramid scheme.
Absolutely.
Somebody starting their own bank and they want to trade in the global currency of, you know, we feel indebted already. So you're going to be born into owing carbon credits to somebody else. And when one company can just buy credits from another and trade them and still pollute, like, what's the sense of it? I mean, it doesn't
make
it.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've been, you know, my eyes have been opened a little bit a couple of years ago by watching the video, The Great Global Warming Swindle. Is that the right? It's like the Zapruder film hoax, isn't it? But then when the ClimateGate stuff came out, and I actually did my own compilation, which turned into a book, and there were like thousands of, I didn't get anything from that either, but, you know, thousands of copies printed in colour, and, you know, it's all over the world. It really was quite shocking to see how flimsy, you know, scientifically this work was that backed up the claims, the temperature claims in particular. And, you know, it was so bad that at one stage I was going to be running for the federal election in Australia, but in the end my wife did run as a candidate for the Climate Skeptics Party in Tasmania. Of course, I didn't get that many votes, but still, it's something which quite shocking. But the whole issue effectively went away before the election because the Prime Minister declared there would be no carbon tax. Right now in Australia, there's been a massive backflip, and Prime Minister Julia Gillard has announced there will be a carbon tax, and there's demonstrations in the streets. That's what it's gotten to in Australia. So, you know,
well,
it's quite
good,
fascinating.
Good, because, I mean, that's it, right? You know, I like the idea of, okay, prove me wrong then, you know? Like,
And I used to believe in all the whole global warming thing because I'm a scientist. And normally, when scientists come out with things, you assume it's been checked as well as, you know, the mass of the electron or the, you know, these nuclear properties, that there are teams of people and it's well established and so on. So I accepted it must be a scientific fact that the whole Earth is going to heat up and, you know, blow up with global warming. And you know, if that's what they found, I just took it because the scientific process normally works. But the people involved in this particular scheme, there was such a small amount and it got blown into big proportions so in such a short amount of time that it was basically, you know, they were pushing people out that didn't agree with them. They were redefining what peer review meant. And the whole thing, as you say, you know, is ultimately...
Well, you know, a failing in our society is we find that time and time again with... Do cell phones cause cancer? Are there problems with vaccinations, you know?
Yeah.
Is there mercury in, you know? I mean, they reviewed it. They've looked at it, and you find that the big pharma is funding all these things, and they have a predetermined outcome. They say, you'll be funded to do this study as long as you, you know, come up with the conclusion we want.
Well, that was, yeah, you know, it was
but constantly, you don't want to...
Yeah, I mean, well, even with the global warming, I was sitting in a seminar just a couple of weeks ago, and somebody had actually been funded to look at the question of how global warming affected the delivery of cancer services to rural areas in our state in Australia. I'm thinking, how does global warming affect that? But it's, again, you know, the money was there to find a link of global warming to anything. And that naturally biases things, because if you don't find a result that confirms there's some effect, you know, then you're not going to get any more funding. So it actually biases it, let alone the people that were actually fiddling the numbers and applying invalid statistical methods. But, you know, like the thing that angers me is that there's enough problems in the world, genuine environmental problems, or even, you know, if you believe that oil is going to run out, if we've passed peak oil. You know, some people do, some people don't. But there are enough genuine problems that, you know, for this global warming to be put up as the preeminent, you know, problem facing mankind that's going to cost trillions of dollars and really affect whole economies, you know, you have to have evidence which is so rock solid to justify that sort of claim, and it just isn't there. That's what upsets me. So... You know, you have to, and I have to be cautious because I did work in finance and, you know, stock markets and so on, but you do suspect that, you know, all of these carbon exchanges that have now collapsed because, you know, the carbon taxes did not eventuate as they expected, were set up as perfect opportunities for people to profit on these products that were actually nothing more than... They were totally synthetic. They were, you know, they were punishing people for emitting carbon dioxide. The strange thing, actually, is that, you know, decades ago in my state of Australia, you know, we were taught in our engineering degrees that our energy is very clean because it's all coal. It's all coal. We burn coal. It makes energy. The only outputs, there's a few trace things, but basically carbon dioxide and water, which are the same things that we breathe out. They're natural gases in the atmosphere. They're totally harmless. It's cleaner than, for example, nuclear power. Suddenly, you know, decades later, because it suits those who look to exploit these sort of things, nuclear power was, you know, was good, but carbon dioxide somehow becomes a pollutant. You know, and so every time you watch the news and they talk about carbon taxes, they show these stacks with this smoke coming out, and they're saying that's carbon dioxide. But anybody that listened when they're at school knows that carbon dioxide is invisible. You know, you breathe out, can you, apart from in Vancouver when it's so cold you can see your breath, but that's something separate. But if you breathe out, you don't see the carbon dioxide coming out. Carbon dioxide is actually invisible. So this is just the water that's condensing out of these cooling towers. It's actually, you know, so when people talk about carbon pollution, even dropping it from carbon dioxide back to carbon, because we're made of carbon, basically.
Yeah.
But to say carbon pollution is already skewing the whole, it's the same sort of propaganda that you get in other areas. And, you know, if the evidence was there, I would have been happy for it. But you know, people can go to my website as well and read what I did is I got all the ClimateGate emails, read through them all, and extracted the key ones and took the jargon out. So when there was some, you know, scientific jargon, I replaced it with something that people can understand. But the actual original emails are still behind there, and not one scientist has come back to me and said that I've misrepresented by simplifying the jargon. So basically you can read the book, you know, just any person that can read English can read the book and sort of judge for themselves what these scientists were doing with the temperature records in particular without having to have a PhD in anything, without having to have a degree in anything. And you can come to your own conclusion. I mean, you know, as I said, I'm not selling carbon taxes or otherwise, and I'm not selling the book either.
Is there a worry about our environment? You know, constantly we should be worried about that. But carbon tax, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, and that's something new on the scene. That, well, I really urge you to watch Jesse's show on it.
Oh yeah, no, I've heard of his work on it, but yeah. Of course,
it was just really good. It was just, you know, it's like we're talking here. You know, just kind of.
And what's his? You know, what's his? Does no, he believe you, in? Does he believe in global warming or? Or does he believe
no,
not
it
in global
was,
warming?
It was slamming the whole carbon tax credit organization, okay. That money-making scheme.
I'll definitely have to watch it.
Right? So I don't think that, he said he was a friend of Al Gore, so he doesn't believe Al Gore is lying. But who's setting up all that? Who's putting the guy on tour? And is Al Gore, you know, sitting on the board of directors of companies? Is he in line to make millions or billions of dollars?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know about that. I have seen things where Al Gore was buying real estate right near the waterfront, which you wouldn't do if you thought that the
it's going to get flooded. But you know, is someone well-meaning being manipulated by something? And the idea is that the carbon credit is the culprit here, the whole scam of people all of a sudden having to owe money.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's a totally synthetic thing, and it's a perfect market for the transfer of wealth. And you know, whenever you've got transfers of such, you know, of trillions of dollars, then there are middlemen along the way that will always take their cut. And so the net effect is that even though you can say we'll compensate ordinary people so that in some states of Australia, power bills are soaring because they've already started taking some action on these things. You can say you're compensating people, but there's always going to be someone taking their cut along the way.
No, it's more than their cut. It's like the 90% of
it. Depends on which market it is, but you're always going to be losing money somewhere, and so you're never going to be able to compensate.
Okay, well, so that's another topic. Before we kind of wrap up here, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to maybe get to a couple of items that maybe I didn't bring up, anything that you wanted to talk about your work, you know, in this journey of looking into the Zapruder film and finding problems, things that have caused you to write on it, to speak, the 2003 symposium and other work. I mean, it seems to be like an ongoing discussion at various forums where people are coming into it and saying, can this be true? You know, how can it be true?
Yeah,
and prove something to me. And
well, it's actually strange. I mean, to answer the first question, I didn't, you know, until half an hour before I came in here, I didn't even remember you were in Vancouver. So I'm completely unprepared to even be here today.
This is
totally off the top of my head. So, and you know, with all of the flying to New York and California and whatever in the last 2 weeks, my brain's pretty fried, as well as driving on the wrong side of the road and San Francisco freeways. That's really, in at night time in the rain, that's something that'll really keep you alert. But it's actually, you know, it's one of those things, and people that research the JFK assassination will say that, you know, you got to be careful. It can take over what you can become obsessed, and it can take over your life. It can destroy marriages and all sorts of things like that. I mean, I did most of my work, you know, in the early parts of the noughties, and then, you know, and I did a couple of things, you know, as we talked about, the witness stuff and the improved frames and the films, but basically I haven't done much in the last 5 or 6 years. But the interesting thing, it's been out there, and even though in the early days of the internet, you go back 10 years, and a lot of the search engines were actually controlled by I won't say by McAdams, but by people like McAdams, let's just say, so that every query you put into some of the big search engines would be redirected to their pages.
Yeah.
Even when you put your own name in, it would be redirected to their pages.
They paid for it, you know.
Okay.
I remember in the early days, McAdams that would say, you know, if somebody typed in Prouty, and then it was said like a penny or two pennies, like they were paying to have their thing listed higher.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard you say that, and I don't have direct evidence, so I won't make that claim, but, that's been said, but and actually just using the internet, it was very obvious 10, 12 years ago that this is what the case. It's actually quite interesting. Apart from Wikipedia, which is a strange beast when it comes to anything that's controversial, when you just look at Google and things like that, it's actually interesting that I think the control over what comes up in sites like Google has been lost. So those people that were manipulating the search engines have actually lost their power because Google has... To stay on top of their game, Google in particular, because it seems to be the best as far as I can see, to stay on top of their game, they've had to build in lots of systems that thwart attempts to hijack their search engine and bias the results, because people would lose they would lose credibility and people would go somewhere else. So it's actually quite heartening that even though there is a bias of a lot of material on the internet, there's more and more, you know, people can find some of these things and the alternative views, like that the Zapruder film has been altered, in increasing numbers. You know, just the YouTube videos of our presentations or the films that I've uploaded or my I haven't got a counter on my pages, but the fact that people can find them now is a little bit heartening. It's a little bit... The pendulum swings and it swings back, and it seems to be swinging back a little bit in favour of, you know, a bit of truth can get out there. There's still people that will manipulate and game the system whenever they can, but... So, you know, your early discussion with Jim, it's a little bit heartening that so many people, and I get emails probably one or two a week from people just interested in this stuff that have just seen it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's great, because I've done nothing on it. I haven't been actively posting on it for years. So I'm just glad, you know, it's out there. I don't make anything from it. I've never made anything from it. People seem to appreciate that I put it out there. They send me emails saying, you know, this is a load of crap. And I just say, oh, well, you know, if you think it's crap, that's fair enough. There's people that write to me and say, I think this is all true and here's some more proofs. And I have to go the other way and say, well, actually, what you found isn't quite right. That doesn't prove anything because, you know, it might have been something that has been pointed out before. It's good just to have it out there. And to a certain extent, I've sort of divested myself of too active a role in this thing. But it's nice that it still lives on. That, you know, my webpage is out there, you Google my name and it comes up, you Google Zapruder stuff and it comes up.
Well, that's part of the discussion then, that, you know, there isn't, the case isn't completely closed. It's not like we're accepting this or that, or new witnesses, new books coming forward. There's, although it's a narrow section of history, it's, I think, very important to what, I think, you know, it's kind of a, I've heard it described like, the apex of an hourglass, like, you know, before the assassination, like the end of World War II, culminating in that pinnacle there where they finally said, look, this guy's got to go. We don't care. Get rid of him. And, you know, and LBJ and all his cronies and Vietnam and everything else after that. And I'm not blaming everything in the world, you know, on the removal of John Kennedy, but it's a pivotal point. If you look into it, when a normal person would say, well, why would the government do that? Or who would do that? You know, you start looking into it, you're overwhelmed with the amount of volume of material there.
Yeah.
And an honest material that says this complete, you know, Warren Commission, everything is a fraud. So when you look at something like 9/11, you shouldn't be so quick to just believe what they said. What do you mean that plane crashed in Shanksville, Pittsburgh, and I don't see any luggage, and I don't see any luggage at the Pentagon either.
Yeah, no,
and at Building 7. And, you know, so regardless of what we could talk for 3 hours on that, it's just
Well, if you want to know my rough overview opinion of those things, people often ask me, and actually people sometimes ask me, I think, because if I give a certain answer, then forevermore they'll say, oh, and he believes 9/11 was totally fabricated and it was an animation as well. You know, that's what some people are looking for when they ask those sort of questions. When it comes to the Pentagon and the plane out in the field, very serious questions. And that was early on, you know, when people were pointing that out, 2002, 2003, you know, Jack White and others.
Well, that day, anybody went out to Pittsburgh, and I'm saying Shanksville, right? That's the city.
Okay.
It doesn't look like anything hit there.
Yeah.
It's a hole in the ground.
The Pentagon one in particular. I mean, as for the Twin Towers, that's a separate kettle of fish. And, people have done.
Well, what I meant to say was Building 7. When I see Building 7 fall, I think something's wrong. Now, you know, no matter where the chips fall, I'm saying I'm interested in this. I'd like to hear more about it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where the idea of Black Op Radio is. I'd like to know more about these topics. You can't investigate everything.
No.
You only have so much time. But
I think you've done a great job of bringing people in that have investigated some of these things. I mean, and you've been going for how long now?
11 years.
Wow, it's a...
And I kind of, even with Jim Fetzer, he started getting on at the end. I called his section the worldview because we would talk about everything then.
Yeah.
And he would talk about a lot of U.S. politics that was just very, if you weren't from that state, I don't think it had a big impact.
Yeah.
And then me being Canadian, even I had less of an interest. Yeah. So, and then he got his own show.
Yep.
So what's it called, The Real Deal? Or several of them, right?
I think I've been on one of those.
I mean, he's had several, a couple of shows, I should say, then.
Yeah.
But I think the latest one is called The Real Deal.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm just saying that, you know, if you want to know more about him and U.S. politics, and I'm sure he's from Wisconsin, so what's going on there, he's probably talking about that. You can find that out, right? But as you just alluded to, for 11 years, I've been started, and I've kind of pulled back into just doing JFK things.
Yeah.
You know, of course, Bobby Kennedy assassination. When anything is in the news, and there's a list of people that, you know, so many thousand a week tune in, I figure if I'm interested, those people would want it, you know?
Yeah.
So
I mean, even from Australia, because that's even further away from the US than Canada is, you know, it was some of those other issues that were not directly global or, say, JFK related. It was difficult sometimes to hear any information. To go through. I mean, you know, it's interesting and so on. No, that's interesting. One of my long, you know, you put these things on list of to-do things, and one was to buy the full archives off you one day and just sit there one spare month or year or whatever it takes to listen to them all one after the other.
But, oh, my God, yeah, it would take a year. Somebody calculated it for me.
How long would it take?
Well, I don't know, but, you know, it was like a year or something like that, right? Well, because the shows are quite lengthy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they're not... They're arbitrary. Yeah. If I had somebody else coming in, I'd have to cut this off. But, you know, so I think what we start at 6 o'clock, it's 9:30.
Wouldn't you be surprised if Gary Mack walks through the door? Gary Mack, come on down.
But this is a 24-hour period, as it says. Anyway, the my map, people won't see this. But so, you know, it's two in Australia.
There's two people in Australia listening. Well, that's listening live. I mean, it's...
Right, right. You know. So it's in a 24-hour period. So it's, I don't know, what's it, 8 in the morning? I don't have...
No, it's 3.
I have a few clocks in the...
Yeah, you haven't got Melbourne. You've got, like, Baghdad. You haven't got Melbourne or Sydney.
I'll tell you a story. The clock stopped at 5:30 in the morning about 5 years ago. Whenever they hung Saddam, I heard they hung him at 5:30 in the morning and the clock stopped. And I haven't touched it since then. Everybody, how come you're leaving it then? Well, when they hung Saddam, the clock just stopped and I figured that was a sign.
Yeah. Well, it's like 3:30 in the afternoon on a Friday, so people are either at work or they're going down for an early beer. Yeah. It's a bit tough.
But anyway, there is a following of people who are interested. So.
It's good, and it's good that you've got the archives there as well that people can get because, I've often gone to the archives and pulled some old ones and had a listen because you know you don't always have time to listen to them every week. So.
Right, and can't. Not every guest will be of interest.
Sure. Yeah.
But if you are, I think one attribute is that, like, for instance, just that you talk, you know, like, okay, no commercial breaks, no come back to that point. You know, let's just see, what has the guy got to say? And that's good.
You've done a good job, mate.
Yeah, thanks. Well, saying that, we should probably wrap up. So is there anything that you want to bring up, maybe, that I didn't get to? You've been taking it easy for 5 years, but...
Well, I'm doing the odd thing. If something comes up, you know, if some other film comes out and, you know, there's interest in where does it come from or something, I'll probably, you know, get interested. But it's only now when I hear something come up, like Clint Hill being on a book tour and actually saying the same story again, then I might do a little bit of work. But I'm sort of sitting back and other people are taking it on and they've all got their viewpoints. Some agree, some disagree. As you said, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And you seem well-centered about that, so I'm happy to hear that, in contrast to Bugliosi saying this will wreck your life and you won't be able to do anything else and you'll be a frantic wreck, you know.
There are people that try and lure you into those sort of modes of working. There are people that will easily distract you and send you down rabbit holes.
Yeah, well I was warned about that from Fletcher, not to cut you off, but just he warned me, there's people out there that are time wasters, and as soon as you pin them down on something, they'll keep changing the argument, the Von Peens, the other people, they'll keep going on and on and on until you feel like, listen, I've already proved this once, right?
Yeah, and I've got to say, there's a very clear difference between someone who's trying to waste your time and someone who writes an email to me that's a genuine newcomer to the field asking a genuine question. Yeah. It's easy to tell the difference.
Right.
In an instant,
but
almost.
We should just say that of someone who's done some research to people, if you get caught into this, if you just to make a mental note, if you get caught but you're writing the same person back the fifth time and you're going in a circular argument, you know, where, you know, how many different things do I have to prove to you?
Yeah, or even...
Then you know someone's out to waste your time.
Yeah, or even if you get to the point where someone's instant messaging you to 4 o'clock in the morning or... Yeah, there's a lot of telltale signs, and you've always got to have a bit of perspective on these things. Even if you don't have a wife or a family or anything like that, always just, you know, think for yourself that there are people who want to waste your time. Maybe some of them just do it out of spite, but I suspect that there's some people that have got deeper motives in distracting anyone that gets too close to some real progress.
Well, from what I'm reading lately, these people are spending time on the different forums or newspaper forums where they are trying to constantly discredit Jack Kennedy and all the things that he stood for and smear him like Bugliosi, like the new, you know, Tom Hanks miniseries and things like that, that, listen, there is a truth about what happened. And I think one of the closest things was Jim Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable. And I think for people to realize that a group of people said, listen, kill the guy, just get rid of him, it'll send a message. That to us is unspeakable. How could that happen? But it did. So, you know, if you want to learn about it, you can, just by looking at the evidence and drawing conclusions, regardless if you believe, you know, Commission Exhibit 399 is the real deal or not. I mean, you know, so I look at it and think, well, there's no way, right? And just like, you know, you look at the film and say, well, there's no way. Everybody said this or that, you know. And
actually, just thinking about that, not to plug your show too much, but it is actually worthwhile for anybody that's getting too deep into any one particular aspect of the research is to maybe listening to, even if, you know, they don't like listening to too many Black Op radio shows, but listen to a variety of them just to realize how many different aspects there are to the case. So if you're drilling too far down into one part and it's taking over your life, you know, you just have to listen to some of the people that come on the show to realize there are many aspects to this. And, yeah, it's possibly the best, most comprehensively investigated murder in the history of mankind. But, you know, you can't let it take over your life.
Yeah, and I think anyway, we're just having a warning, recognize that, you know. No sense falling into the Bugliosi trap where he claims that's all you know and that's it. So we have other interests. People have other interests. It shouldn't take a whole lifetime to put this in perspective. I do a show once a week, you know, just as bringing up people who have an interest in this, and that's my contribution.
Yeah, it's a great hobby. But if you do spend a lot of your life on it for a short period of time, then come on, Len Show, and describe it. Like we did. No, I mean, it's all right to do in short pieces. You just don't want to do it for 10 years and lose everything else.
Yeah. Okay, well, that wraps up tonight's show then. Thanks so much for dropping in. So first of all, thanks for calling me, and thanks for, you know, saying, you know, you're in the neighborhood.
No worries, mate.
So maybe
I was walking around Vancouver and thought, I don't know anybody. But, you know, then I know one.
Yeah.
And you just happen to be doing the show in like 10 minutes' time.
Yeah. I said, yeah, I can't talk right now. I'm going on the air, and you got the cabin down here. Okay, well, obviously we've been speaking to John Castella, and I will make links to all his website and books, and you can take it from there. So thanks so much, and call it a show. Okay, good night, everybody.
You've been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network. Black Op Radio presents Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, the DVD Complete Collection. Finally, the DVD set you've been waiting for is available. Over 15 hours with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Over 15 hours. Over 15 hours. Over 15 hours. Interviews with Len Osanek, John Judge, David Ratcliffe, and more. This is a one-of-a-kind set. These interviews feature Fletcher Prouty having candid conversations regarding his 23 years in the military, but specifically 9 years in the Pentagon from 1955 to 1964. His inside knowledge is invaluable to researchers of this era of American and world history. These are the revelations you've been waiting for. Over 15 hours with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, the complete DVD collection. Available at the Colonel Prouty reference site, www.prouty.org, and blackopradio.com. New from U.S. author Mike Palachek, Camp America. Here's what American poet David Ray has to say.
Mike Pelichek reminds me of Socrates, the gadfly who asked unwelcome questions. Diogenes with his lantern looking in vain for an honest man. Chekhov, the man with the hammer, challenging the complacent family to share their meal. Kerouac, the ever-on-the-move, somewhat hysterical searcher. And he also reminds me of many Americans who, as children, were so blasted with propaganda that they're devoting the rest of their lives to challenging the lies and all who tell them. In this land where babies are brought by storks and buildings collapse due to unpatriotic bricks, we need the gadfly. Because no leader, preacher, guru, or saint will wake us up, though the doomsday clock is ticking close to 12. David Ray, American poet, author of The Endless Search and The Death of Sardanapalus and other poems of the Iraq Wars. To order Camp America and all of Mike Palachek's books, go to the New American Dream website, www.newamericandream.info. Howard Zinn writes, Mike Palachek writes with passion, wit, and always with a strong social conscience. Camp America. From author Mike Palachek. The website again, newamericandream.info.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder. It's a political rally. A free speech zone. A town hall meeting. It's an interrogation at NSA headquarters. Now, it's time to make a statement. Time to represent. Time to let them know who you are. That you're part of the Black Op. With a brand new Black Op Radio t-shirt. Comes in all sizes. Wear it loud and proud. Join the Black Op today. www.blackopradio.com. Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it? Who did it? The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. If you believe there's more to the JFK assassination and the mystery surrounding the CIA and its covert operations, you're not alone. Meet the man Oliver Stone called X in the epic motion picture JFK. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty comes forward with never-before-seen or heard documentation and information about JFK, the Vietnam War, the CIA, and more on a brand new CD-ROM. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty is an incredible offer not to be missed. For a limited time only, find the answers surrounding these issues and more with the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Call now at area code 604-525-4167. That's area code 604-525-4167. Or visit the Colonel Prouty reference site on the World Wide Web, the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight. We are pleased to announce Volume 1 of Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty on DVD. This first one-hour DVD goes through the 1960 U-2 incident with Gary Powers. Colonel Fletcher Prouty reveals his inside knowledge of the incident, his office in the Pentagon, Operation Aquatone, Soviet overflights, and the similar Alan Pope incident. It is Prouty's position that the U-2 flight was sabotaged by the members of a secret team to stop the crusade for peace and embarrass President Eisenhower, thereby heating up the Cold War. And of course, Eisenhower warned everyone of the industrialized military complex that he had learned of firsthand in this incident. You will learn Gary Powers' U-2 never was shot down at 70,000 feet, as claimed in every single history book. Four separate interviews on one DVD, a one-of-a-kind must-have for anyone interested in finding the truth behind the cover story. Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight.